Welcome to the reading of Quad City Times for April 17th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Pam Rhodes and Patty Daniels. Here's our first story from the front page of the QC Times. The court questions January 6 charges. Ruling expected this summer could have broader repercussions. By Mark Sherman of the Associated Press. Washington. The Supreme Court questioned Tuesday whether federal prosecutors went too far in bringing obstruction charges against hundreds of participants in the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot. It wasn't clear how the justices would rule in a case that also could affect the prosecution of former President Donald Trump, who faces the same charge for his efforts to overturn his election loss in 2020. The justices heard arguments over the charge of obstruction of an official proceeding in the case of Joseph Fisher, a former Pennsylvania police officer who was indicted for his role in disrupting Congress's certification of Joe Biden's 2020 presidential election win over Trump. Fisher is one of 330 people facing that charge, which stems from a law passed in the aftermath of the Enron financial scandal more than two decades ago to deal with the destruction of documents. A decision is expected by late June. Trump faces two charges in a separate case brought by special counsel Jack Smith in Washington that could be knocked out with a favorable ruling from the nation's highest court. Next week, the justices will hear arguments over whether the former president and presumptive nominee for the 2024 Republican nomination has absolute immunity from prosecution in that case, a proposition that so far was rejected by two lower courts. I'm trying to find this. The rest of this article. Here we go. Smith argued separately in the immunity case that the obstruction charges against Trump are valid no matter how the court decides Fisher's case. The first former U.S. president under indictment, Trump is on trial on hush money charges in New York and has also been charged with election interference in Georgia and with mishandling classified documents in Florida. It was not clear after more than 90 minutes of arguments where the court would land in Fisher's case. Conservative justices Samuel Alito and Neil Gorsuch appeared most likely to side with Fisher, while liberal justices Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor seemed more favorable to the Justice Department's position. Justices Amy Coney Barrett and Ketanji Brown Jackson, a former federal public defender, expressed interest in more of a middle ground outcome that might make it harder, but not impossible, for prosecutors to use the obstruction charge. Some conservative justices said the law was so broad that it could be used against even peaceful protests, and also questioned why the Justice Department has not brought charges under the provision in other violent protests. There have been many violent protests that have interfered with proceedings, Justice Clarence Thomas said. He was back on the bench Tuesday after an unexplained one-day absence. Gorsuch appeared to be drawing on actual events when he asked Solicitor General Elizabeth Preligar whether people could be charged with obstructing an official proceeding if they rose in protest inside the courtroom, heckled the president at the State of the Union, or pulled a fire alarm in the Capitol complex to delay a vote in Congress. Alito, suggesting the government's reading of the law is too broad, asked whether the charge could be applied to people who disrupted the day's court session by shouting, "Keep the January 6th insurrectionists in jail," or "Free the January 6th patriots." He hastened to add, "What happened on January 6th was very, very serious, and I'm not equating this with that. The high court case focuses on whether the anti-obstruction provision of a law that was enacted in 2002 in response to the financial scandal that brought down Enron Corp. can be used against January 6th defendants. Lawyers for Fisher, the former North Cornwall Township police officer, argue that the provision was meant to close a loophole in criminal law and discourage the destruction of records in response to an investigation. Unlike the Capitol riot, lawyer Jeffrey Green told the court on Fisher's behalf, the provision had never been used to prosecute anything other than evidence tampering. But Preligar, the administration's top Supreme Court lawyer, said the other side is reading the law too narrowly, arguing it serves as a classic catch-all designed to deal with the obstruction of an official proceeding. She said Fisher's actions before, during, and after January 6th demonstrated that he intended to keep Congress from doing its job of certifying the election results. He had said in advance of January 6th that he was prepared to storm the Capitol, prepared to use violence. He wanted to intimidate Congress, Preligar said. He said they can't vote if they can't breathe. And then he went to the Capitol on January 6th with that intent in mind and took action, including assaulting a law enforcement officer. The obstruction charge is among the most widely used felony charges brought in the massive federal prosecution following the violent insurrection. It carries a maximum prison term of 20 years, but Preligar said the average term imposed so far is about 2 years. About 170 January 6th defendants have been convicted of obstructing or conspiring to obstruct the January 6th joint session of Congress, including the leaders of two far-right extremist groups, the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers. Some defendants had their sentencing delayed until after the justices' rule on the matter. Some rioters even won early release from prison while the appeal is pending over concerns that they might end up serving longer than they should have if the Supreme Court rules against the Justice Department. More than 1,350 people have been charged with Capitol riot-related federal crimes. About 1,000 of them pleaded guilty or were convicted.
QC to be warmer and wetter in the future. More destructive floods likely due to climate change. This article is written by Sarah Watson, and you can contact Sarah at swatson@qctimes.com. More intense flooding, drought, and hotter temperatures are expected in the Quad Cities in the coming decades as a result of climate change, according to a new report. The assessment, titled Navigating Climate Challenges in the Quad Cities, was done by the National Wildlife Federation, Prairie Rivers Network, and the Discovery Partners Institute at the University of Illinois System in an effort to analyze the potential impacts of climate change on the Quad Cities through the end of the century and offer general solutions. Climate change is a long-term change in the average weather patterns locally, regionally, and globally. Changes in Earth's climate since the mid-20th century are driven by human activities, according to NASA, particularly fossil fuel burning, which increases heat-trapping greenhouse gas levels in the Earth's atmosphere, raising Earth's average surface temperature. Average temperatures have risen about a degree in Iowa since the beginning of the 20th century, concentrated in the fall and winter. We found that the Quad Cities will begin to experience more frequent and more destructive floods shortly, said Arsam Pathak, senior adaptation specialist for the National Wildlife Federation. Our research also shows that solutions such as permeable pavement, green roofs, and stormwater gardens can significantly reduce flooding. 7 of the top 10 historic crests of the Mississippi River at the Rock Island Gauge have occurred in the 21st century, according to the National Weather Service. Flood simulation is done by the scientists in the report show the areas close to the Mississippi River becoming more prone to river floods because of increased rainfall and higher stream flows. The report stated places such as Cargill Ag Air Horizons, Isle Casino Hotel Bettendorf, and the Martin Luther King Center, Vibrant Arena at Mark, M-A-R-K, Mark, and Lindsay Park Yacht Club could become susceptible to flooding as early as 2040. Water from heavy rain events could impact areas like the I-74 bridge and downtown Rock Island by 2080 or 2090. The Quad Cities can also expect more days reaching above 95 degrees. Under a high emission scenario, the Quad Cities could experience nearly 2 months of temperatures soaring above 95 degrees, according to the report. The area currently experiences an average of 3 days over 95 degrees a year. Read the full report online here. Our analysis suggests the Mississippi region will experience warmer and wetter conditions in the future, along with an increase in extreme precipitation events, said Ashish Sharma, the Climate and Urban Sustainability Lead at the Discovery Partners Institute. The risks of climate change in the Quad Cities will more greatly impact people living and working in floodplains in Moline, East Moline, and downtown Davenport, along the Mississippi and Rock Rivers, the report said, and will disproportionately impact vulnerable populations such as lower-income families, people experiencing homelessness, and people with disabilities. The report recommends nature-based solutions to combat the impacts of climate change on the region in the coming decades. Those include restoring wetlands, floodplains, and forests, which would reduce the risk of flooding and flash flooding, according to the report. Nahant Marsh, for example, in western Davenport, acts as a massive urban floodwater sponge, according to the report. It catches and filters up to 2 billion gallons of water during peak flows on the Mississippi River. Pathak said wetlands such as Nahant Marsh will face challenges with disruptions in water balance because of more frequent droughts and flash flooding, and that impacts of climate change would become more severe without resources like Nahant. The report also recommended increasing tree cover to shrink heat islands and provide more shade during periods of extreme heat. As part of the review, researchers interviewed 30 regional natural resource professionals, conservation staff from the cities of Davenport, Moline, Rock Island, East Moline, and nonprofit and community leaders. Researchers emphasized the findings of the assessment are not static, and there's inherent uncertainty about future changes to emission trajectories, population changes, and the limitations of climate modeling. The findings seem like a lot and a little scary, but this is by no way meant to be a doom and gloom report, Pathak said. The risks are not static. They are still based on projections, emission scenarios. The actions and policies we can take on today can change the future greenhouse gas emissions and the flooding scenarios.
Boil order issued in Moline. Main failed around 40th Street and 2nd Avenue. Written for us by Anthony Watt of OConline.com. A boil order will remain in effect at least through Wednesday morning for a large part of Moline after a water main malfunctioned. The north and south boundaries of the boil order are the Mississippi River and 12th Avenue, and the east and west boundaries are the East Moline border and 34th Street, Tony Lett, the city's utilities director, said Tuesday morning. The city is testing samples of water and should have results late Wednesday morning, he said. If they are good, the order will be lifted. If not, the order could be extended. The failed main is around 40th Street and 2nd Avenue, according to a city news release issued Monday night. It is a 12-inch cast iron main that was installed in the late 1960s, Lote said. When city workers examined it, they determined part of it had rusted through. They repaired the main and returned it to service about 5:30 a.m. And from the Iowa State House, traffic cameras to be regulated by Aaron Murphy of Gazette. Des Moines, automatic traffic enforcement cameras would not be banned in Iowa, but they would be regulated and their use limited under legislation receiving final approval from lawmakers Monday. The legislation, which requires local authorities to receive a permit from the state to place a traffic camera and stipulates how local governments would be required to spend revenue from tickets, needs only Governor Kim Reynolds' signature to become law. That a traffic camera bill is headed to Reynolds' desk is a significant development. Where previous legislative attempts, mostly to ban the devices over the course of multiple years, have failed. But momentum for addressing traffic cameras built during this year's session as more of the devices have cropped up across Iowa. This has been a long time coming. I think 5 or 6 years we've delayed this. We've debated this, Senator Tony Bisignano, a Democrat from Des Moines, said Monday during debate in the Senate. We were in such a tie down, a ban or no ban. This came to make sense. There is a need for automated traffic cameras, especially in the urban areas. As of January, the state's nonpartisan legislative services agency, which provides statistical analysis for the Iowa legislature, found 25 cities in Iowa with automated traffic enforcement cameras operating in the 2023 fiscal year. The agency was able to obtain data on traffic camera usage in 10 of those cities, including Cedar Rapids. Cedar Rapids had 19 traffic cameras, including at least 4 locations around the S-curve on Interstate 380, operating in fiscal 2023, according to the agency. The city issued nearly 170,000 citations and collected fines in 55% of those, producing $7.2 million in revenue, according to the analysis, far more than the other cities measured, including Des Moines. According to data from the City of Cedar Rapids, the per-month average of total crashes and crashes with an injury in the city have fallen since the traffic cameras were implemented there in 2010. Marion began operating automatic traffic cameras at 2 locations in 2023, and University Heights said it was installing them at 2 locations this year. Iowa's 377 traffic deaths in 2023 were the state's most since 2016, and the state's 11.2% increase in vehicle-related deaths from 2022 to 2023 was the nation's fourth highest, according to a recent federal report. Under the approved legislation, House File 2681, local governments would be required to obtain a permit from the Iowa Department of Transportation to place an automated traffic enforcement camera on any Iowa road. Exiting existing cameras would be allowed to continue operation until October 1st, but local governments must obtain an Iowa DOT permit to continue them beyond that point. When applying for a permit, the local authority would be required to provide supporting data, including traffic and crash figures, that illustrate why a traffic camera is needed in that location. Cameras could be used to cite only drivers who failed to yield or stop at a traffic signal control intersection or railroad crossing, or who exceed the speed limit by more than 10 miles per hour. Local authorities would be required to review and approve a record of the alleged traffic violation captured by a traffic camera before a citation is issued. Cedar Rapids, among other cities, already meet the requirements. Cities with a population of 20,000 or less would be prohibited from issuing fines from violations observed by mobile automated traffic enforcement cameras, equipment installed in a vehicle or trailer parked along a shoulder. Those cities could have only warnings for violations observed by mobile devices. Local governments would be required to spend post-installation and maintenance revenue from traffic camera citations on transportation infrastructure projects or police or fire department operations. Of the 10 was able to acquire traffic cameras usage data, 6, including Cedar Rapids, send traffic camera ticket revenue to the city's general fund. Cedar Rapids says revenue from its traffic cameras is directed to public safety and was budgeted in fiscal 2023 to fund 33 officer positions as well as law enforcement programs and equipment, each as maintenance of policy, such as maintenance of policy and body cameras. Waterloo sends its traffic camera ticket revenue to the general fund to be used for police equipment. Buffalo puts its toward public safety, Muscatine toward police personnel, and Des Moines to its public safety radio system and the Iowa statewide interoperable communication system. Those who have sought to ban automated traffic cameras say their use violates constitutional due process. This bill was a good first step. However, it is still my belief that traffic enforcement cameras are unconstitutional and a money grab, Senator Brad Zahn, a Republican from Urbandale, who has led the charge on traffic camera legislation in previous years, usually in an attempt to ban them, told the Gazette. Zahn voted in favor of the bill, which passed the Senate on a near unanimous 46-1 vote. It previously passed the House 85-12. Mike Kilmish, a Republican from Spillville who was that town's mayor for 22 years, said during Senate debate that he believes the legislation establishes a very robust regulatory framework that requires local governments to justify the need for traffic cameras. Reynolds' office did not respond to a request for comment on the legislation. This year, in an attempt to secure enough votes to pass his legislation, Zahn combined his proposed traffic camera ban with a proposal that drivers use only hands-free technology when operating a mobile device, a provision that is highly sought by law enforcement officials. That combination upset some Iowans, including advocates for the hands-free requirement, who want to see it passed into law. Law enforcement officials have asked lawmakers in recent years to pass legislation to ban handheld use of mobile devices while driving in Iowa. Officers say the state's prohibition on texting while driving, enacted in 2017, is difficult to enforce because drivers can say instead were making a call or using the device's GPS, which still is allowed under Iowa law. A proposed hands-free requirement, Senate File 547, overwhelmingly passed the Iowa Senate last year, but the House hit the brakes. Despite data showing the dangers of phone use while driving, Representative Brian Best, a Republican from Glidden, who chairs the House Transportation Committee, said there are not enough votes among House Republicans to pass the bill in the GOP-controlled chamber. I'm disappointed. I wish we could have done something with it. But it's not just going to happen this year, Best said. Maybe next year, with retirement, maybe there will be some different ideology that come in that might support it.
First Trump trial jurors seated. Choosing a jury could take days. Proceedings expected to last weeks. The first seven jurors for Donald Trump's hush money trial were seated Tuesday after lawyers grilled the jury pool about their social media posts, political views, and personal lives to decide who can sit in fair judgment of the former president. The jurors include an English teacher, an oncology nurse, and a corporate lawyer. 11 more people still need to be selected before opening statements begin in the Manhattan case, accusing the Republican of falsifying business records to cover up a sex scandal during his 2016 campaign. On the second day of jury selection, New Yorkers were quizzed for hours about their views on Trump and other issues, and eight were excused after saying they could not be impartial or because they had other commitments. Several would-be jurors told the judge they believed they could decide the case fairly, no matter their feelings about Trump or his policies as president. The methodical process could take several more days or even weeks. The trial is expected to last for 6 weeks or more. The trial, which began on Monday, puts Trump's legal problems at the center of his closely contested race against President Joe Biden. It's the first of Trump's four criminal cases to go to trial, and it may be the only one to reach a verdict before voters decide in November whether to elect the presumptive GOP presidential nominee. Trump looked on in the courtroom as his lawyers urged the judge to remove one potential juror for a social media post she made after his 2020 election loss. Trump at one point spoke loudly and gestured while the judge questioned the woman, causing the judge to admonish the former president. "I don't know what he was uttering, but it was audible and he was gesturing and he was speaking in the direction of the juror," Judge Juan Merchan said. "I won't tolerate that. I will not tolerate any jurors being intimidated in this courtroom." And one little short article before we go to the obituaries. Johnson pushes ahead with aid for U.S. allies. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, pushed back Tuesday against mounting Republican anger over his proposed U.S. aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and other allies, and rejected a call to step aside or risk a vote to oust him from office. "I am not resigning," Johnson said after a testy morning meeting of fellow House Republicans at the Capitol. He indicated he would press forward with a U.S. National Security Aid package, a situation that would force him to rely on Democrats to help pass it, over objections from his weakened majority. He called the motion to oust him not helpful. "We are simply here trying to do our job," said Johnson, who appeared emboldened by his meeting with Donald Trump late last week.
Now for the obituaries, and I will first read the pendings. Joseph D. McKnight, 92, of Milan, passed away on Sunday, April 14th, at Silver Cross Nursing Center, Rock Island. Arrangements, Wieland Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Milan. Dennis M. Laird, 74, Moline, Illinois, passed away on Tuesday, April 16th, at his home. Arrangements, Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory, Rock Island. Keith R. Diana, 34, of Davenport, formerly of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, passed away Saturday, April 13, at his residence. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial of Moline. Mary Ann Finch, 81, of Preemption, died on Monday, April 15th at Clarissa C. Cook Hospice House in Bettendorf. Arrangements, the Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Milan. Robert J. Moon, Jr., 82, of Chicago, passed away April 11th at Glenview Terrace in Glenview. Arrangements are pending at Esterdahl Mortuary and Crematory in Moline. Kathy J. Doyle, 70, of Moline, passed away April 13th at OSF St. Francis Medical Center. Arrangements are pending at Esterdahl Mortuary and Crematory in Moline. Larry Jacob Leftwich, 85, of Moline, passed away Monday, April 15th at UP Trinity, Rock Island. Arrangements pending at Rafferty Funeral Home in Moline. Patty J. Robinson, 59, of Moline, passed away Sunday, April 14th at Genesis Illini Campus, Silvis. Arrangements are pending at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Rock Island. And from Davenport, Boo T. Tong, 71, of Davenport, passed away on Monday, April 15th. Visitation will begin at 10 a.m. on Thursday, April 18th, at the Runge Mortuary, followed by cremation at 2 p.m. Boo was born on January 1, 1953, in Saigon, Vietnam. In 1968, she was united in marriage to Phan Nguyen. She enjoyed shopping, going to the casino, karaoke, and spending time with her grandchildren. Those left to cherish her memory include her husband, Phan, her sons, Chan, Tom, Paul, and Nam, along with her grandchildren, Alyssa, Lana, Tyler, and Arabella. She was preceded in death by her mother, Liam Tong.
Dolores Dot Marie Hogarth Cassidy. Dolores Dot Marie Hogarth Cassidy, 93, passed away Monday, April 15th in Davenport, surrounded by her loving family. Funeral service and mass of Christian burial will be Friday, April 19, at 10:30 a.m., with visitation beginning at 10 a.m. at Sacred Heart Cathedral, Davenport. Halligan McCabe DeVries is assisting the family with arrangements. Dot is the beloved mother of five children, and she is survived by Maureen, Ann, Mike, Patty, Sean, and seven grandchildren, Stephanie, Justin, Coy, Zach, Rachel, Kirsten, Matthew, and Catherine, in addition to seven great-grandchildren, Braden, Amelia, Wyatt, Mason, Adler, Addie, and Carson. Dot was born in 1930 in Davenport to John Cecil Hogarth and Helen Slattery Hogarth, attended Sacred Heart Catholic School, and graduated from Immaculate Conception Academy in 1947. She attended Mary Crest College and married John F. Cassidy from Ohio, Illinois in 1950, raising her family in Monmouth, Illinois and Dubuque, Waterloo, Sigourney and Centerville, Iowa until John's death in 1980. Besides raising her children, she taught piano lessons and passed on her love of music. Dot returned to school after her husband's death and received a B.A. in psychology in 1984 from Truman State and B.S.W. from Kearney State College in Nebraska. in 1987, where she had moved to be closer to her oldest daughter and family. She embarked upon a successful career in social work for the next two decades, including as part owner of Rest Care Incorporated, a provider of mental health case management in southeastern Iowa, until retiring in 1995. After retirement, she spent time with family, friends, and her longtime loving companion, Delmar Holtz. She traveled with friends to Europe, Alaska, and various places in the U.S., was active in her church, tutored reading to elementary children, and continued to attend musical events. She visited her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren often until Parkinson's disease no longer allowed her to travel. She returned to Davenport in 2015 to be near her daughter Anne and family, but maintained contact with friends, some she had for over 50 to 70 years. What Dot enjoyed most of all, though, was time spent with her loving family. Dot was preceded in death by her partner, her husband John, a half-brother, Joseph Kriegel, and loving companion, Delmar Holtz. In lieu of flowers, the family requests those who wish to express sympathy to consider making a donation to Sacred Heart's Minnie's Maison Clothing Center. That's https://www.clothingcenterqca.org, which is across the street from where decades ago Dot, as a young girl, lived with her mother. The John and Dot Cassidy Scholarship Fund was established within the Centerville Community Schools Foundation by her children to honor the public service of Dot and her late husband, John. Online tributes may be expressed at www.hmfuneralhome.com. Gregory J. Milder, 64, of Keokuk, formerly of Davenport, died Sunday, April 14th at Mississippi Valley Nursing and Rehabilitation Center in Keokuk. Funeral services and masses of Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, April 18th at Our Lady of Victory Catholic Church in Davenport. Burial will be out at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Davenport. Visitation will be held Thursday from 10 a.m. until the time of Mass. Memorials may be made to Our Lady of Victory. Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. Gregory John Miller was born October 13, 1959, in Cedar Rapids, a son of Maurice and Joan Vasky Milder. Greg graduated from West High School in 1978 and later from Scott Community College with an associate degree in computer-aided drafting. He had a passion for trucks and modifying them, as well as tinkering around with his computer. Greg is survived by his mother, Joan Milder of Davenport, siblings Teresa Milder, Martin Miller, Jeanette Mosley, Andrew Milder, and a nephew, Mark Mosley, and Aunt Karen O'Hara of Omaha, Nebraska. He was preceded in death by his father. Online condolences may be expressed by visiting www.hmdfuneralhome.com.
George Dennis Cummings. George Dennis Cummings, 79, of Davenport, passed away peacefully on April 11th in Iowa City, surrounded by his family. George was born on May 13, 1944, in Burlington. After George graduated from Central High School in Davenport in 1962, he worked for a while and enlisted into the Air Force. After the Air Force, he began his electrical apprenticeship and worked at Alcoa for over 30 years, where he retired. George was a proud member of Union IBEW 1379. Throughout the years, George enjoyed scuba diving, travel, the symphony, theater, and musicals. George was an avid supporter of the fine arts scene around the area, faithfully attending the Quad City Symphony, Circuit 21 shows, and other outings. His love of Christmas radiated figuratively and literally. through not only cheer, but hand-painting figurines for his Christmas village with his daughter, putting enough lights on the house to land a plane, and making his own holiday decor. He loved movies, his favorite shows, and all things technical. In 2005, George met Pat at a retirement party for a mutual friend from Alcoa, fell in love, and got married in 2012. George was predeceased by his parents and his brother, Craig and Hank Torres. He's survived by his wife, Pat Cummings, daughter Vanessa, stepchildren Sylvia Decker, Miguel Flores, Marco Flores, Jen Sandman, and first wife, Anna Maria Taylor Cummings. He is loved and missed by his grandchildren, Phoenix, Hayden, Harper, Sean, Hannah, Dylan, and Amelia, extended family, and Boris and Natasha, the kitties. A celebration of life will be held on May 13th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Black Hawk Hotel. Online condolences may be made to the family by visiting his obituary at hmdfuneralhome.com. And Robert J. Troffer. On April 20, 2024, noon to 4 p.m. is the celebration of life for Robert J. Troffer at Credit Island Lodge on Credit Island. He was Davenport High wrestling champ in 1952 and a true bassmaster and a top-notch contractor and or carpenter for Troffer Home Builders. Also built the first 24-hour storage company in the area, Northwest Storage. William Bill M. Bentley, 74, of Davenport, passed away peacefully at his home on Sunday, April 14th. Services will be held at 10 a.m. on Friday, April 19th, in the Runge Mortuary Chapel, with visitation beginning at 9 a.m. He will be laid to rest in National Cemetery, Rock Island Arsenal. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to K9, Kindness Rescue, or Beacon of Hope Hospice. Online condolences may be expressed at rungemortuary.com. William was born on September 15, 1949, to William E. and Catherine Smith Bentley in Salamanca, New York, on August 12, 2006. He was united in marriage to Diana Shump Ward in Davenport. He worked in roofing and siding and lastly at Friendship Manor, retiring in 2012. William enjoyed fishing, hunting, golf, and making furniture in his wood shop. Those left to cherish his memory include his loving wife, Diana, children, Melody, Brooke, William, and Dave, 9 grandchildren, 9 great-grandchildren, and brother, Wayne. He was preceded in death by his parents and granddaughter, Aurora. Linda M. Creo, 78, of Bettendorf, passed away on Sunday, April 14th, at her residence surrounded by her family. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. on Thursday, April 18th, at Bettendorf Presbyterian Church. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. until the time of service. Memorials may be directed to Bettendorf Presbyterian Church. McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. Linda was born on March 28, 1946, in Burlington, to Jack and Mary Huntley Orr. Following high school, she continued her education at AIC Business College. She married Joseph Creo, and together they owned and operated Su Casa Taco House in Bettendorf. Most recently, Linda worked at Teske's in Bettendorf. She enjoyed crafting, cooking, dancing, but most of all, spending time with her family and church family. Linda had a zest for life and was known for her infectious personality. She was an active member of Bettendorf Presbyterian Church, where she participated in various ministries. Those left to honor her memory are her daughter, Dawn of Eldridge, and 8 grandchildren, 13 great-grandchildren, and roommate Chris Hill. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by her husband, Joseph, daughter Sean, Ronnie Lehman, and half-sister Betty Stoffelt. Online condolences may be shared with Linda's family at McInnesChambers.com.
We're turning now to the opinion section of the Quad City Times, and here is an article written by Andrew Prokop. How Trump's hush money trial went from afterthought to main event. When former President Donald Trump was indicted in New York for falsifying business records last March, many anticipated that would be the prologue to the main event, charges over Trump's attempt to steal the 2020 election. Yet, the 2 election indictments and another prosecution of Trump for hoarding classified documents have moved slowly and been beset with delays. That means that, suddenly, the question of whether or not Trump will be convicted of crimes before November's election may hinge on the Manhattan trial that started Monday, which is a bit awkward because the actual matter at the heart of this trial is clearly the least important, having the least significant implications for the country of the 4 prosecutions brought against Trump. The New York trial is broadly about the $130,000 hush money payment Trump's lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen paid for Stormy Daniels shortly before the 2016 election, so Daniels wouldn't go public saying she'd had a sexual encounter with Trump. But the 34 charges are specifically about whether, when charged later repaid Cohen for that money, the Trump Organization falsely logged those payments as legal expenses in company records. That false labeling, prosecutors allege, is a crime here. Compared to trying to steal the 2020 election or hoarding documents with national security secrets, this doesn't seem like the most substantially important topic. But those cases are very unlikely to land in a courtroom before November. So the questions of whether Trump will face the November voters in November as a convicted felon or even a convicted felon with a prison sentence hanging over his head may well be determined by what happens in a Manhattan courtroom over the next few weeks. Paying hush money sounds shady, but in and of itself it's not illegal. Well-known figures from time to time pay people to keep them from coming forward with embarrassing stories. But Cohen had paid Daniels $130,000 for her silence shortly before the 2016 election. Federal prosecutors have argued that this payment was clearly designated to help Trump win, and therefore it was effectively a campaign contribution from Cohen to Trump, far greater than the maximum contribution allowed in federal campaign finance law. Cohen pleaded guilty to this in 2018, saying he was acting at Trump's direction. But Trump was not charged by federal prosecutors. Justice Department guidance about not charging a sitting president took that off the table. And even when Trump left office, the DOJ decided not to reopen the case. So state prosecutors in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office stepped in, launching a sprawling investigation of Trump's business affairs that, after a long and winding road, ended back at the hush money. More specifically, it ended with charges that Trump's repayment to Cohen for the hush money were improperly classified as legal expenses in internal Trump Organization documents. This violated New York law against falsifying business records, prosecutors allege. Furthermore, the DA's office argued that these charges should be felonies rather than misdemeanors because the records were falsified with the intent to commit or conceal another crime. What crime that would be exactly has been the subject of some dispute, but they have said that federal election law, state election law, or tax law could fit the bill. Still, the somewhat bizarre situation here is that Trump isn't being charged for paying hush money. He's being charged for failing to scrupulously keep honest records about it. District Attorney Alvin Bragg's case was greeted with much tut-tutting from pundits and some legal experts who argued that the legal reasoning behind the case was flawed. Yet all doubts the big deal brains might have been about the theories behind the prosecution won't necessarily matter to jurors who are tasked with answering the basic question, did he do it or not? In this case especially, the first stage of the trial, jury selection, will be tremendously important. Jurors are told not to let their outside information and potential leaning effects affect their judgment. But obviously, that could still happen, either deliberately or simply through bias. Trump's biggest problem is geography. Jurors will be from Manhattan, where President Joe Biden won 84.5% of the vote in 2020. Trump has dealt with Manhattan juries in 3 civil trials over the past year, none of which went well for him. He was found liable for sexual abuse and defamation and was ordered to pay hundreds of millions of dollars in fines. Still, Trump's biggest advantage is that he only needs to convince one juror. Conviction requires unanimity on the jury, so even if one juror wants to acquit, Trump skates. And not everyone in the jury pool will be a die-hard Trump hater. There will be some Republicans and some who are not politically engaged. This article was written by Andrew Prokop, who is a senior politics correspondent at Vox, covering the White House, elections, and political scandals and investigations. His column is syndicated by Tribune Content Agency.
We have time for a little bit of sports, so that's what we're going to do. And from the front page of the sports section, we have Cardoso, Reese, bring star power, WNBA draft. Chicago selects 2 players it targeted. Written for us by Andrew Seligman of Chicago. Camellia Cardoso and Angel Reese took South Carolina and LSU to the highest heights and helped spark a surge in women's basketball. No wonder the Chicago Sky were beaming. They landed 2 of the biggest stars, not named Caitlin Clark. They landed 2 of the biggest stars, not named Caitlin Clark, in a loaded NBA draft on Monday. This is a chess match, Coach Teresa Witherspoon said, and we actually got every player that we had designed to get. This is an exciting moment for us, exciting moment for the city, and this is an exciting moment for the Chicago Sky organization. The Sky took Cardoso with the number 3 pick after she led South Carolina to a perfect season and the NCAA championship. Reese, the LSU star who won the NCAA title in 2023, got elected 7th overall. Chicago, which won the WNBA championship in 2021, is banking on the 2 to help lead the franchise back to the top. The Sky went 18-22 last year and lost in the first round of the playoffs. Former coach and general manager James Wade left in the middle of the season to take an assistant coaching job with the Toronto Raptors and was replaced on an interim basis by Amre Vatanseur. The Sky hired Naismith Hall of Famer Witherspoon as coach in mid-October and promoted Jack Pagliocca to general manager nearly 3 weeks later. When it came to the draft, the new regime did what it could to put Chicago in position to get Cardoso and Reese. In early February, the Sky dealt 2021 Finals MVP Catherine Copper to the Phoenix Mercury for 4 draft picks, including the number 3 choice this year. They acquired the number 8 pick from Los Angeles 2 weeks later. Sunday, they traded up a spot with Minnesota. Chicago also drafted Gonzaga guard Brenna Maxwell with the first pick of the second round at 13th overall. We're not that far removed from a championship, Bagliocca said. We've had great records. We keep making the playoffs. We're not trying to slow down whatsoever. So we needed players that were going to come in and want to make winning plays. And the culture that they came from has got to mirror something that Coach Spoon is going to bring. The 6'7" Cardoso led South Carolina to NCAA championships in two of her three seasons following a transfer from Syracuse. She was most outstanding player of the Final Four and capped it with a dominant performance in the Gamecocks championship win over Clark and Iowa. She had 15 points and a career-high 17 rebounds in a game that drew more viewers than the men's final between UConn and Purdue. Reese, who played 2 years at Maryland and two at LSU, averaged 18.6 per game and 12.3 rebounds in college. She was a three-time All-American and the SEC Player of the Year this past season. LSU won the NCAA championship in 2023 and reached the Elite Eight this year, losing to Iowa after beating the Hawkeyes for the title the previous year. And now, it's time for us to go away. It brings us to the end of the Quad City. I'm Patty Daniels, and my partner at the microphone has been Pam Rhodes. You can listen to IRA's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRA's, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.